7BR Part Heard. Hello, and welcome to 7BR's Part Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. I'm Rhys Palmer, Chambers Paralegal. We're joined today by 7BR's member, Justin Slater. Justin practices as a trial advocate within the full spectrum of child law. He has specialist knowledge in public law, care and adoption proceedings. He has previously joined the podcast to discuss topics such as parental alienation and domestic abuse and private law children cases. Both episodes can be found on Chambers' website. Justin has recently been published in LexisNexis Family Law, covering the topic of parental alienation. He is back today to discuss the new emerging landscape of fact-finding hearings in family law proceedings. Justin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Rhys. Thank you for having me back. And what a silky radio voice you've got. I hadn't appreciated.
thank you.
And thank you for your help also in that publication on parental alienation. I think it was an important article that needed to be written, but not for today. Today we're here for fact findings.
Yes. And I'm sure you could talk about the various pros and cons to fact findings for a very long time, but we're here today to talk about quite a specific point. But before we go into that, can we just start with the basics? What are fact findings and what do they look like in practice?
Okay, so fact findings are really, from my perspective as a practitioner, the heart and soul of family law proceedings, whether they be public law proceedings where the state is intervening in family life, or the more complex cases of private law dispute where there may be some significant issues as to removal from the jurisdiction or as to domestic abuse. I think I make it clear at the outset, Rhys, that the focus, how I'm using the sort of the term fact-finding, is really in what is becoming increasingly a less worn path in terms of having a split hearing. So in other words, a separate hearing to determine facts, hence fact-finding, that is separate from the final determination, what we might call the welfare or has been referred to as a disposal stage, but I think most people prefer welfare. It's really what I would call the gold standard in terms of the courts really getting to grips with issues in any particular set of proceedings. And I think the death knell that rings for this sort of setup of a separate hearing in advance of a final hearing is really rung now loud and clear. I don't think they'll ever disappear, of course, but we certainly, I think, are at an opportune point to put out a pod like this, because the pressures on the court are such that I'm increasingly having situations at court where judges are pushing back very strongly in cases which ordinarily, as night follows day, would have had a separate fact-finding hearing. So that's why I think I wanted to talk about this with you today, Rhys.
So you're saying that judges are pushing to bring the welfare hearing and the fact-finding hearings together. What does the court decide when they're trying to determine whether or not a fact-finding hearing is necessary?
What does the court have to decide? The shortest question, I suppose, that the court has to determine there is that it's that old classic in family law, is it necessary? I think the difficulty in terms of my opening sort of gambit for you just a moment ago is that the arguments to say it's necessary to have a separate hearing, classically they would be because of the complexity of the issues or because further time is needed post a fact finding in order for the judgment to settle in other words, for the respondents to get used to this new factual landscape, which the court has determined, and then perhaps go on to further assessments. I think the reality that practitioners have now is that the top-down pressure on the courts to keep listings to a minimum in any particular case and to stay on track with the 26 weeks that came in with the 2014 legislation is such that it is very difficult to stake a claim for a separate hearing, because judges are classically saying, and they have been for a while now, but they say with a firmer voice now, what we will do is we will have experts, and for that read medics, psychologists, psychiatrists, but also filtering down to guardians and social workers, providing reports for the court as to the way forwards on a sort of dual basis. So in other words, classically, on one basis, the facts have gone one way, and on the other basis, the facts have gone perhaps diametrically opposed on the other way. Now, my view is that that's very difficult for professionals to do, but it's, I'm afraid, the new landscape that we find ourselves in. Can I just go back a little bit, really, to just some general sort of points about fact findings and their nature? I don't want to give the impression that they were always 10 a penny. That hasn't been the case since, you know, certainly 2010. The presidents have been saying, you know, we need to reduce the number of these types of hearings. So they've always been rare. You know, they've been in terms described as being these cases should be rare. And practitioners understand that. But I think it's the rarity of these types of hearings that really now is becoming emphasized. And so we are far more likely to go back. You remember at the outset, Reese, I spoke about, want to talk about fact findings in terms of a separate hearing. What they're saying now is they're having a fact finding element of a final hearing. So it's all being wound up into one final hearing. And again, of course, there's nothing new in that. All I'm saying is that is happening now as not only the norm, but it's becoming increasingly difficult to advocate for separate hearings, even where, you know, the view of perhaps all the practitioners quite legitimately is, you know, we really need a separate hearing here.
So you're talking about fact-finding hearings not being the norm, but practitioners requesting them almost as if it were the norm, and that it being a necessity on the basis that cases are complex or specific facts need to be clearly identified, and that these are trying to be dealt with in the early part of a final hearing. When I'm thinking about this, and you're saying that experts are now having to give diametrically opposite opinions to say if the facts were this way or if the facts were another way, that seems slightly counterintuitive and convoluted when actually a fact-finding hearing is the correct approach to allow both sides to set down the parameters and then tackle the actual substance of a case with the facts being laid out.
Well, Reese, I think your instincts are right. I mean, I think that's the cause of my concern and other practitioners. But it goes to show, I think, the strength of the pressure which is on the court system. And I think the reality here is that we're in a situation where, and it's to an extent an artificial situation insofar as it doesn't relate to any facts of any particular case. But judges just don't have the time to put in separate hearings of, you know, perhaps multiple days in order to have these matters litigated. And so they are falling back on previous case law, which suggests that these cases should be rare in any event as a justification for really, I wouldn't say extermination, but that they are rare. I think in terms of the basics, again, what sort of a fact finding might look like, they should on paper all look the same. They are, after all, a set of days set aside for the facts of a case or the bedrock of that case to be determined. I think in reality, they're as varied as flowers in the meadow. They can take any number of different ways forward. I recently was in a case with one of our QCs, Mr. Roach, Queen's Counsel, where we had 3 or 4 weeks set aside for a very serious investigation of of sexual assault against against a child. That child was in her teens, and she was prepared to come to court to give evidence. And you can imagine we'd had extensive case management hearings prior to that. There'd been extensive communication with the police and the lead officer so that the criminal jurisdiction knew what the family jurisdiction was doing. Yet, despite all that, on day one, we had an application not by the police, but by the CPS, the prosecuting authority, to say that the child should not be giving her evidence in the family court because she was due to give her special measures evidence only a few weeks after we were due to have this fact-finding. And they didn't want, for obvious reasons, her to be giving her evidence in one jurisdiction, namely to the family court, and then a few weeks later having to repeat it all to the criminal court. So albeit that is an extreme situation, you know, these things are more common, I think, than you might imagine. And I think the point I'm making here is that what it shows is the real flexibility, and this is an absolute positive point, I think, for the family court. It shows the flexibility that trial judges have in the family jurisdiction to find a way around situations like that. There were various approaches that could have been taken. One approach could have been that the court simply proceeded on the basis of what, you know, the accused, one of the alleged perpetrators, a member of the family, had already accepted, and just jettison off the other points because what had already been accepted was very serious. So that was one approach. Another approach might have been to simply adjourn it and go round it. Another approach might have been, and this I think is where your ears prick up as a practitioner, especially if you are representing someone accused of very serious matters, is just proceed without the teenager giving her evidence in terms of you'll have her ABE, her Achieving Best Evidence, recorded interview, but you wouldn't have an opportunity to challenge her directly. And in this case, remember, that is what had been set up. That's what had been envisaged and considered the right approach. So you can just proceed on the basis that, you know, the accused goes in the box, answers all the questions, but effectively the accuser doesn't face cross-examination. You know, these things really, I think, set the family courts apart from the criminal courts. One other approach, which is possible and is worth practitioners bearing in mind, is that you can simply take an approach of, look, I'm not contesting this. I don't agree with the allegations, but I'm not going to contest them. I don't perhaps want to give evidence. I'm not going to challenge anybody. I don't agree it, but the court will look at it on the basis of the evidence that it has sort of on paper. It's akin to when you have more regular directions hearings or hearings which are looking at specific issues, and you, instead of calling evidence, you just deal with it on submissions. I think practitioners know that if you do that, you are really going into the fight with one hand tied behind your back. So I think that raises the question, you know, well, why then would you do it in a fact-finding hearing? And I think sometimes you've got to remember what you're trying to achieve for your client in a fact-finding hearing, because, you know, quite often there are the grey clouds of criminal proceedings looming after the fact-finding hearing. And you may take the view, your client may take the view, I'm only going to make things worse for myself if I go into a full-blown, fully challenged fact-finding hearing and have a full-blown, as it were, fact-finding judgment at the end of it, which may well put some nitrous fuel in the prosecution's lunch, as it were. But you may also take the view that you've just got nothing to win in terms of the case. In other words, forget about criminal proceedings, but you just may not have a position in relation to whether you're putting yourself forward to care for a child. And I think that's really where the key to some of the other points we'll talk about later comes in, is that whether you have these fact-finding hearings, there has to be a point to it. So we're not in the business of prosecuting people because they've done something wrong. That's for the criminal courts. We're in the business of working out only those facts which are relevant to provide a sensible narrative upon which to make decisions for the child in the future. And I think it's a real mindset issue that even experienced practitioners can increasingly, I find, stumble with. You get an approach sometimes from local authorities, which is, you know, a bad thing has happened here. We want to get to the bottom of it. But if the person who's alleged to have done that bad thing is not putting themselves forward to care for the child or has made significant other concessions in terms of what they say, okay, that did happen. They may say other things didn't happen. But if what they've said is enough to rule them out as a carer for the child, or such that any involvement they have with the child going forward would be shrouded with very significant protection, I think it's then legitimate for the courts to say, and they do all the time, you know, there's no point having this investigation. It's not going to take us anywhere. And I think that's where you get a very receptive audience from the court.
We know that the courts, not just the family courts, generally all courts have this massive backlog. They're completely overworked and there aren't enough open courts for cases to go ahead as swiftly as we would like. We've now, I say we're coming out of, but we are still in this COVID era and period where there are hybrid hearings, remote hearings, in-person hearings. Everything's still a bit in a state of flux. How has that impacted the family court in particular when we look at having fact-finding hearings separate to a final hearing?
Yeah, and I think as we've touched on, it's done two things that we've already mentioned. Firstly, it's reduced the number of these split hearings that we have. I mean, that it slightly depends on where you are in the country. It depends on, you know, the ideas that your particular lead family judge has in that area, but and of course their own diary commitments. But it's done that. Firstly, I think the other thing it's done is that it's, as we've mentioned before, it's allowed for this, I'm probably going to call it relatively new, it probably isn't now, this tendency to ask professionals to report on this dual basis, so either or. And I think just to say a few more words about that, sometimes that's quite sensible. But I have had situations where, you know, guardians and other professionals have felt that isn't the right thing to do. And courts, you know, would be wise perhaps to really take heed when a guardian's saying that. I think you also sometimes have, just on a practical basis, some difficulties with funding. You ask an expert to report on one set of facts or another set of facts. I've had experts turn around and say, well, that's two sets of instructions. You're asking me to do something entirely different. You're asking me to do double the work for the same money. And I think that's a practical consideration. COVID, of course, caught us all by surprise. We had the President's Road Ahead document that was published in 2020, and then again, I think it's been amended in July of this year. And the focus there is, you know, increasingly on delay and really the need to have these hearings, and the court exercising what it calls very robust, I think it's even italicized, but very robust case management. Because an important element of this, Rhys, is, you know, at the point that the court decides whether or not to have a fact finding, that is a judge decision. It's not led by the parties. We, as much as we like, we can tramp into court and say, this has been agreed, judge, this is the best way forward. It's a judicial decision. It's also a case management decision. And what that means is the welfare of the child is a very important consideration to weigh in the balance, but it's not a paramount consideration. It doesn't override everything else. It's something which is at the discretion, as I say, of the judge. It's not a question of legality. It's a question of really the overriding objective for the court and how best to do justice to the case. In other words, how are we going to get from point A, where we are now, issue of proceedings, to point B, which is decisions being made for the long-term welfare of these children in terms of contact, in terms of placement, in terms of perhaps therapeutic needs. Those are the decisions that are the foremost of the judge. And I think the issue of delay, the reality is that is often determinative now. And of course, when I say delay, what you need to be thinking of is, from a judge's perspective, they'll be thinking, look, if I'm ordering 2 5-day hearings 3 months apart from each other, as Mr. Slater wants me to do, because that is, he says, the gold standard, well, I don't have that court time to do it. And even if I did, that is going to, by definition, delay proceedings. It's going to be that much longer than simply having perhaps a 7 or an 8-day hearing at an earlier point. This is, and I raise this just anecdotally, but again, I think if it's happening to me, it'll be happening to others. It's an early stage decision that's made. You know that, Reese. You alluded to it a moment ago. It's a decision that's made at the earliest possible juncture. I recently did a case where I came in late in the day, and an allegation had been made against my client of sexual abuse in, I think, the February of this year. And it was only raised by the local authority as an issue, although all parties were aware of it because we'd had police disclosure. All parties were aware of it. And it was only raised, I think, in August. And then they only determined what they were going to do about it in September. I mean, that may be an extreme case, but you see the impact of then, you know, your litigation world is turned upside down. You're going back to basics, as it were, on your primary source evidence on another issue, which should have been dealt with. The nettle should have been grasped on that issue way back as it appears, actually. Almost at the start of this year. So months and months have been lost. But other impacts of COVID, I think, are attending court. We have these hybrid hearings. I think increasingly my view is that it's possible to challenge witnesses. Of course it is, on an audio platform such as CVP that we have in court. That's been done. There's nothing new there. Certainly, it's very, very helpful when it comes to experts, people who have, you know, busy clinicians who would rather be performing operations on children, to put it in the extreme, than waiting around at the family court. That's all entirely legitimate. I think, though, when you come to challenging very significant lay witnesses as to fact, then attendance is needed. So I think the hybrid is working, but I think practitioners do need to be very aware that it is more difficult, in my view, to really engage with a witness of very significant importance without being face to face. But that will depend on the facts of each case and whatever particular way of dealing with it suits the advocates at the time.
Yeah, of course, that is quite paramount, I think, as you've highlighted. But just jumping back a second, you were talking about robust case management. You mentioned the overriding objective. And when we look at things being fair and proportionate, and I think we're all familiar with various legal tests saying to look at all of the circumstances in the case, when we are limiting or narrowing fact findings and trying to bring them together and shorten the court's time, is that not potentially detrimental to either or both of the parties, as the facts haven't actually been properly thrashed out to allow them to defend or argue their points coherently?
Reese, I think that really lies to the heart of any barrister worth her salt is the question of, you know, how's this going to impact on my right to a fair hearing? Or even if it doesn't go that far, how's it going to impact on my client? The point to make, I think, is that, you know, not having this split hearing structure only impacts the respondent party, so mum, dad, and the children, or any interveners, so people who have been, you know, the finger of blame's been put in their direction. So in other words, people who have the most to lose are being compromised. I'm not saying in fact being compromised, but they are the ones for whom there is a question about how is it impacting their case. Because the local authority will come, bring a case, and, you know, often it's a question of setting up the evidence and then the judge will make her way through it. They're very rarely in a position where they're going to be compromised in how they put their case. So I think, you know, that is of crucial importance. I think the reality is something's lost. And I think that goes to the heart of, if there's a complaint in what I'm saying, that's it. Because very often the ability to have a split hearing allowed for people to listen to what the judge had said by way of reading the judgment, you know, just in a human level, thinking about it for a couple of weeks, putting in a statement in response to that, then perhaps being assessed as to that going forwards. I think if we are, though, to realise that we're in this position, and don't forget, this is a position which really case law has always said, you know, fact-finding split hearings should be a rare beast. So we are in this position anyway. But I think what we can do is we can certainly look to make hay where we possibly can. And one area which I think I've certainly had a great deal of success recently is using this time-crushed, time-pressed situation that the courts find ourselves in, and this desire to reduce the issues, something which we should always have been doing, but we actually really are now doing in the family courts, is you can knock out great swathes sometimes of the local authority's schedule of findings that they want to have found against you. Because you simply say to the judge, well, look, where's this taking us? You know, all so this finding, you want to know X, who did this, or what the circumstances were that my chap did that. But you can have a very compelling argument now to say, judge, just focus on what you need in order to make your final welfare determinations. I say you don't need this information. And very often, of course, if you can then say, well, if you do go down that route, I'm going to need X, Y, and Z witnesses, and it's going to take another 3 days of court time. I'm afraid then you have a very compelling argument to a judge to say, you know, if there's going to be a fact finding, massively reduce it, or we don't want a fact finding anyway. Because don't forget, a lot of the time, it won't be in your client's interest to have a fact finding hearing, because they may only be looking at a one way stream of evidence there that may end up in very difficult findings being made against them. This is nothing new, of course, but I think we are in a slightly heightened state now with the hugely time crunched pressures on the court diary to say, don't pursue these findings against my client because they're not necessary. And if you do, you're going to be impacting, you know, delay, as I said, the road ahead. The president's view is, you know, very robust case management. Delay is always a negative, or to be considered a negative for the child in terms of delay to proceedings being wound up. And so I think then you can certainly use that to your advantage. I think if you're for a local authority, I suppose you might not want to be sidetracked, as they might see it, hunting down other allegations that are made as between different respondents. So again, I suppose that might go to your advantage. You may simply say to the court, look, I don't want to spend the time at this fact-finding hearing looking at these other elements because they're simply not needed. And I just think any argument that's based on that sort of reasoning is hugely supported now because of the time delays.
Well, Justin, thank you for everything that you've just explained and set out. Is there anything else that you'd like to highlight before we conclude this podcast today?
I would, if I can. I've got some thoughts on some of the pitfalls, and they just really echo the sorts of things we've been talking about already, the leading authority on whether to have fact finding and what sort of ambit of a fact finding should be is an Oxfordshire case. We can put a link to it in the description, as they say, if needed. But I think, you know, what the president was telling us back then is that the court is not interested in the pursuit of criminal matters. It has very helpful checklists as well as to when you should be going into fact findings. But I think the point I draw out of it is that we're not interested in pursuing criminal matters. This is not a criminal jurisdiction. It sort of echoes what we were saying before. I think you can very often read very punitive schedules that they don't seem to be always focused on issues that are, again, this mantra, issues which are central to the future determination of the welfare issues for a child. In other words, where that child's going to be, who it's going to be living his life or her life with. But they chase down, as it were, each and every hare running on the field about various allegations or actions, which may well have been criminal actions. But the point being is you don't need to do it. And we are not in the business of doing that. I think the other point that I'd like to raise is about the language in schedules, because in the same way that we don't chase down every bad act that has ever been committed within that family network, we also don't import the language of the criminal courts. Now, the case for that is a 2018 case. Again, it's a president's decision. It's Re-R. In that case, it was quite unusual because it was a fact-finding that followed on from the sad facts. I think the father had killed the mother, but had been acquitted of all counts in the criminal courts on the basis, I think, of self-defense, then went in front of the High Court for a fact-finding. And the local authority there, so remember, here I don't think we're chasing down issues that don't need to be looked at, that obviously the taking of life of the mother obviously is very important, but here's a subtle distinction. We're talking about the language of the criminal courts. So they used in their schedules words like unlawful killing, unreasonable force, unlawfully, recklessly. And it was actually, it wasn't a point of appeal by the father, but it was raised by the court, the appeal court itself, who said, you know, midway, as it were, during submissions, why are we dealing with the language of the criminal courts? Why are we dealing with criminal terms, sophisticated, complicated terms of criminal law, specific to the criminal law? Because they have no place here. I think very quickly, all the advocates jettisoned all of that. They understood immediately that it was not right. And they looked to go ahead by simply saying, look, forget the language here. The facts are the same and the findings should stay as they are. I think the Court of Appeal wasn't happy with that, though. And for various reasons to do with Article 6 on an unrelated issue, they felt that in that instance, it was significant enough to order a rehearing. Now, I've myself again recently had at least two cases where the language was full of this sort of criminal jurisdiction language, you know, terms, concepts, ideas, which are particular to the criminal courts. They come with their own jurisprudence. They come with their own rules of evidence. They come with judges who are qualified to hear them, because, of course, not all family judges are qualified to sit in the criminal courts. You are adding a whole layer of complexity that the Court of Appeal just said, it's not needed. It has no place. And I think, again, as a practitioner, you know, when you read those thresholds, when you get hold of the case, if you read a threshold or a schedule of findings that is sought, you know, if you see language like that, this is a very good case. Get it out. The other reason I think you need to get it out is because the last thing you need, I think, is a finding from the family court, which, you know, may be used or may be looked at within the criminal courts, which uses criminal language. I think that will set off all sorts of alarms. The final thing I think was just to point out a case. It's again, it's a Peter Jackson case. It is reported as RECi and HDH children fact finding July 2021. And it really helps you there, I think, with setting out in real detail all the considerations that come into play when you're looking at either the scope of a fact finding or whether to have a fact finding or not. Again, the focus on delay comes through, sets out very helpfully the statutory framework that really anchors these decisions, stresses again the points that we've said already, Rhys, about active case management. And I think there were two, that case looked at two appeals together. One appeal was allowed, one wasn't. In essence, my reading is that the one that was allowed was because the judge really hadn't looked at all elements of the case. Yeah, so weighed everything in the balance. Because it's such a fundamental decision whether or not to have a fact-finding or not, whether to pursue errors or not. But one of them was allowed because the appeal court felt that actually all matters had been considered. So I think, again, when you're a practitioner looking at those sorts of next steps you might have after a decision, that's a guiding principle that we seem to have from the appeal courts.
Thank you, Justin. That was very informative. And I think we will be able to link some of those cases and that can be found on Chambers' website.
Thank you.
But no, thank you, Justin, for joining me today. Thank you to our listeners. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode and Justin's insight into family law proceedings. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more like this on Chambers' website and other major streaming platforms. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.